welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. John Kasich continues to shoot down rumors of a unity presidential ticket between him and Colorado's Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper. The two have been working together on what they call a bipartisan fix to the nation's health insurance woes. But Kasich put the rumors to bed on Sunday during an interview on NBC's Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
Because Hickenlooper and I work together, cynics out there say, well, they want something. Because we want to stabilize health care and make sure that poor people have something, people assume there's a motive. You know, sometimes people actually do things because they're trying to help somebody. And when we do that, everybody ought not to say, well, what's in it for them? This growing cynicism eats at the fabric of the spirit of our country. It's not.
We're talking about Governor Kasich and more state politics this hour on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff. Laura, welcome back as always.
Thank you for having me.
State government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Welcome as always, Karen.
Great to be here.
I feel like welcome back to me. I haven't done a reporter's roundtable in a month. Hello, everybody out there. So why is it cynical to think that these two have something more up their sleeves? Laura Bischoff?
I don't necessarily see it as cynical. They're both political office holders and ambitious. And I think, there's in the following politics world, there's constant speculation, and talk. And it's interesting, the Columbus Dispatch had a story, I think it was either today or yesterday, talking about how John Kasich has made more appearances on national TV, like 39, than official appearances in Ohio, 37.
Right.
Year to date.
He still hasn't been on All Sides with Ann Fisher, just saying. Jesse Ballmer, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's something. There is a lot of speculation about what John Kasich is going to do after he's governor of Ohio, and there's a lot of speculation about whether or not he will run again in 2020. And so I think just this Hickenlooper situation feeds right into that. And I think it's something my colleague and I reported that they had discussed, but John Kasich has also discussed a lot of things about his political future. So I think it's more in the unlikely camp than anything else. But I think the fact that we're talking about it is not surprising nor cynical.
And I'm lucky enough to say that or unlucky, depending on your point of view. I've interviewed Kasich a couple times on our TV show, The State of Ohio, but I've had to travel three times to get him. I had to go to Cincinnati, I had to go to Westlake, and I had to go to, I think it was Findlay.
Not going
to
make it easy.
Yeah. So, but I think, naturally you look at Kasich and you see how many times he's been on national talk shows compared to, say, how many appearances he's had as governor this year, how many times has he been on Sunday morning talk shows. There's a lot. And he is technically unemployed beginning of January 2019. So, I think naturally with some of the things he's been saying about the way he ran his campaign and the things he talked about in 2016, that, he's certainly looking at something ahead. And, Governor Hickenlooper is not term limited, but Kasich is. And so, he's looking ahead to his opportunities down the road.
I do think that Kasich genuinely wants to have a voice on the national stage, and to promote, what he sees as solutions. He wants to fix Obamacare rather than have it tossed out entirely, because he sees the value in expanded Medicaid, for example, in Ohio, has helped some 700,000 people and has really expanded access to drug treatment and mental health services.
And he did say yesterday that when Chuck Todd asked him on Meet the Press, is it Donald Trump's Republican Party or is it the Republican Party that you joined some 30-some years ago or whatever? And Kasich said, I have a right to define the Republican Party the way I want to. And, other people can do it their way. And I think that's something that Kasich's been saying all along, that he feels like he is a leader in this party and he has every right to say what he would like the party to look like.
He does have the distinction of being the ultimate holdout when it comes to Donald Trump. He's the only one who said, no, I will not endorse him and I will not support him.
He paid for that, though, I think, in Ohio. I think there are people who are still angry at him in Ohio for not getting behind the president and doing what was the original promise at the very first Republican debate in Cleveland. They were all asked, are you going to get behind whoever the candidate is? And everybody but Donald Trump said they would. And so I think there are people who are still angry at Kasich. But then there are others, more moderates and some Democrats, who feel that he stood up to Trump. And they're happy about that.
And continues.
And I think he has this stage because he was a holdout and never kind of was back and forth about Donald Trump from even the beginning. And also, I think on the national stage, people are looking, Republicans agreeing with Republicans and Democrats agreeing with Democrats is kind of standard fare. And so a Republican disagreeing with the Republican president is a little bit different. That's why John Kasich and also Jeff Flake, the senator in Arizona, have had such a platform.
And not only disagreeing with Republicans, but also reaching across and working with a Democrat in terms of the Colorado governor.
It made me think about all of this when I was listening to Texas Senator Ted Cruz talking about the hurricane damage down there in Texas. Of course, it's devastating. It's catastrophic. But I couldn't help but think, gosh, I haven't heard from Ted Cruz in a long time. Not everybody buoyed since the election 9 months ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't heard a lot from Cruz either. You're more likely to hear some criticism coming from Marco Rubio,
right,
maybe.
In Florida, right.
It also might just be a function of, I'm not in Texas and I'm not paying as close attention to the U.S. Senator from Texas.
Well, and when there were 17 candidates in that race, I guess it's easy to forget about how many that there were and to hear from only certain ones. And I think we've heard a lot more from even John McCain and some other people who weren't candidates in 2016 talking about their concerns. I've heard a lot from Lindsey Graham, though, who was he ran in 2016, so there's that.
The question is, why are networks continuing to seek interviews with John Kasich? And that is because he will speak out against the president. And that's kind of tough to find, all things being equal.
Well, and he does these interviews. He's very willing. You'll see him quite often. And I think that's the role that he's carving out for himself. I think the networks really like to have that, like Jesse was saying, that point of view.
Yeah.
And he'll do these interviews.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the Ohio the GOP-controlled Senate voted last week to override six of the governor's Medicaid-related budget vetoes. And there are more to come, perhaps, down the road. They still have it. As long as the budget's open, they can override vetoes. So what does that say about the relationship the governor has with the Ohio General Assembly going forward, Jesse Balmer?
So I think for the General Assembly, the Republican-controlled General Assembly, we should note,
right,
this was a way to make a statement that whatever John Kasich has as far as policies is not necessarily what they're going to go along with. And overrides are part of the legislative process, but it's something that we haven't seen on a budget for about 40 years. And this is the first time that John Kasich has ever had one of his vetoes overridden. And so it's notable in that regard. But the actual six items that they chose to override, I think they're not kind of like the big ticket items that people were most concerned about. I know initially there was a proposal to freeze the new enrollment in Medicaid expansion, and that was something that caused a lot of consternation that didn't get off the ground in the House yet. And then going over to the Senate, there was a lot of discussion about this money for counties and transit authorities, and that was something that the Senate chose to not take a look at either. And so I think those were bigger priorities for the Kasich administration than these six that were overridden, but it certainly sends a statement from the Republicans and lawmakers that they're not just going to go along with what John Kasich says.
Hmm. Kind of a stick in the eye then.
Well, and I think it was interesting that the transit authorities, the veto that specifically related to the transit authorities, that came up but then was pulled back because it sounds like there's negotiations going on to try to make some sort of a deal, because there are Democrats who actually are going to support this veto override. They don't want to see these transit authorities left without about $200 million a year that they raise on the back of this tax.
And Senate President Larry Obhoff has said that this is something they are willing to come back to as soon as the beginning of September. And so I think for them, having the potential to override this item is a bit of leverage in their negotiations with the governor's administration.
Does the governor have much leverage at this point as we look forward a year and a half, you know, through the year and a half ahead of his, you know, term?
Well, I would say that his big lever is the state budget, and he's done his last budget.
Right.
And so now his lame duck status really kind of settles in. You know, I mean, he's still the governor. He can wield a lot of power, but it's diminished at this point, I would say.
He even mentioned it on Meet the Press yesterday that the Senate had overridden six of his vetoes, which was an interesting thing to bring up on national television. He got six of his vetoes got overridden. So, but I think there's coming clashes maybe on, you know, we've got these energy issues, the renewable energy standards. There's also this bill that would allow for some subsidies for First Energy to bail out its nuclear power plants. He says he doesn't like that one either. So there's some tension here.
Also, I would say that the legislature has moved over the years, has moved farther to the right.
Right.
With every 2 years, it seems like it gets more and more conservative.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to be putting things out there that, in contrast to Kasich, is going to be.
Sure. I think Karen's right. I think there's going to be more tension.
Yeah. Yeah. We are going to take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to our weekly Reporters Roundtable on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. With me in the studio, Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also, Jesse Ballmert, State Government Reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. And Laura Bischoff, a correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Laura Bischoff, you covered a Bernie Sanders rally last week. Tell us about that. And also, I wanted to make note of the fact that Bernie Sanders has continued to at least gather steam. Whether he's building up enough to make much of a difference going forward is debatable, I suppose. But he's still out there, too.
Sure. He did a three-city tour last week. He went to Indianapolis, Portsmouth, Ohio, and then Detroit. And his goal was to kind of talk about issues like the opiate addiction crisis, college affordability, good-paying jobs, and then sort of talk about progressive solutions to these issues. You know, he drew about 650 people on a Tuesday morning in Portsmouth, which I thought was, you know, pretty good crowd for given the time frame. I think that and also that's a pretty good crowd given that 65% of Scioto County went for Trump.
Right.
Hillary Clinton got crushed in those southern counties, and actually pretty much the counties from Ashtabula all the way south along the river to like Claremont County. I think that he was trying to say that, you know, that regardless of party, that there are solutions to these problems.
And how did the crowd respond to him? I mean, what are they – was it Bernie faithful?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It was definitely a very pro-Bernie crowd of people. There were a few people – it was held at Shawnee State University, and there were a few people who said, well, I just – you know, I was curious what he had to say. We don't usually get very big names around here, so they showed up. And then while I was there, I was reporting on a story about Trump voters, so it was a good contrast to go – from a Sanders rally then over to like downtown Portsmouth and the farmers market area and kind of talk to folks from that whole area about how they see Donald Trump now 9 months into it. And, you know, for the most part, they're still standing by their man. They like his blunt talk. They're okay with his response to Charlottesville. They say that a lot of the problems that he's encountering are caused by the media and by Congress and opposition in Congress. And I will say that some of the people I talk to, they're not John Kasich fans. His name is kind of mud down there. They don't like expanded Medicaid, even though I would dare say there's a big percentage of people in that county that are on Medicaid, and they don't like that John Kasich is, you know, such a vocal never Trump guy.
So there's Donald Trump is in the 30s in terms of overall approval rating, right?
Right. He's at about 35%. The Daily Gallup poll has him.
Right. But among Republicans, it's more like 77%.
Yeah, I think last week it was at 79%.
Okay. All right.
That was the first time it dipped below 80. It has eroded a little bit among Republicans, but it's still fairly strong.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to Kerry right now. He wants to talk about Governor Kasich. Hi, Kerry. You're in Columbus. Kerry in Columbus.
Good morning, first-time caller. This sounds like a cliched phrase, but first-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that in short order, I was a young Republican and was a staunch Republican, and over the years, my politics changed. I think the party changed more than I did, and I'm actually a pretty progressive in my mind, and I vote Democrat. But Kasich, to me, is a breath of fresh air. I respect him, and he reminds me – I'm 60 years old, and he reminds me of the Reagan, first Bush, the Muskie, McGovern, Humphrey-type politicians where he's a statesman. And I don't hear him to be that disparaging to other people. And I was so impressed about a month ago. There was a town hall on CNN with he and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. And these were two men that exemplified what American politics should be about. Neither one raised their voice. Neither one criticized the other person directly or insulted the person. And both respected the views and offered alternatives. And I...
Oops. We lost Kerry somehow. Sorry about that, Kerry, but point taken.
And I think voters like Kerry are exactly who John Kasich is speaking to, those people who are maybe a little more centrist or a little bit more liberal and who can get behind a Republican like John Kasich. I'm not sure there's a huge lane in that if he were to pursue a presidential campaign in the future.
You know, and the other thing I would say is that John Kasich – given his positioning right now, he would – I don't think he could ever make it out of a GOP primary for president.
Right.
You know, it's more likely that the hard right people are the ones who are going to win the nomination. And John Kasich is just a little bit too middle of the road for a lot of the primary voters.
By no means is he anything but a conservative.
I was just going to say that. I think, you know, he's anti-abortion. He's pro-death penalty. He wants lower taxes, less regulation. He's definitely a conservative.
What distinguishes him then? He's definitely a conservative, but he's not what kind of conservative? What's the magic X factor when it comes to getting through a Republican primary then?
Hard line on wedge issues like immigration and Obamacare and, you know.
What some people might consider extreme.
Okay.
Because I think that's what it takes to win a primary now is to going to the left far, to the right far. That's what a lot of happens in a primary. And so, yeah, I think if Kasich would position himself as a moderate in a primary, it'd be very difficult for him to do well.
Yeah. And I think especially the point of expanding Medicaid through Obamacare is something that people in like in my coverage area, like the Butler and Warren counties of the world, those conservatives are just never going to forgive him for adding this additional, you know, large bureaucracy, in their opinion, to the state government. And you know, his speech of this is what he needs to do for when he goes to the pearly gates is kind of falling on deaf ears in those parts of the conservative party and the Republican party.
This is where the governor said he had a moral obligation to do this, that this is how, so he could sleep at night kind of speech.
And he's urged other Republicans that this is when you're called up there, what are you going to say? So that's.
Gotcha. That's right. That's right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also, Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, is trying to change its feathers yet again. What's going on?
Well, ECOT, as has been widely reported, ECOT's graduation rate is, and it's the state's largest online charter school. It's the one that is embattled in this fight with the Ohio Department of Education, because the Ohio Department of Education and a couple of court decisions have ruled that ECOT overestimated its full-time student enrollment by about 9,000 kids. So that means the state paid them $60 million extra for the school year 2 years ago, and now the Ohio Department of Education is taking back some of that money in its monthly payments to ECOT, because ECOT continues on as an online charter school. So now ECOT is talking about has proposed to change its status to a dropout recovery school. ECOT graduates about 39% of its student body.
Which is not good.
Well, compare that, yes, to the average public school is 84%. So 39%, that's a terrible rating as a traditional school or as a charter school, and would give it an F in that category. But if it becomes a dropout recovery school, because those students are harder to reach, because they have history of dropping out and that sort of thing, 8% is considered a success rate for a dropout recovery school. So ECOT would look like it was doing excellent work graduating 39% of its student body, and in a standard where 8% is what's considered good.
If you become a dropout recovery school, is there more to the equation than what the standards are? Does it change the curriculum? I mean, are parents who are considering putting their kids in ECOT going to think twice? That's
a really good question, and I'm not sure exactly what all the standards are for the students. I mean, are they allowed to accept students who have not dropped out at one point? Because a dropout is considered an event, not a student. So
right.
A student can drop out three times. That's three different events. That I don't know that a student would have to officially be considered a dropout to be in a dropout recovery school. But certainly this is raising questions, I think, for some people about not only should ECOT continue to operate, but also what are we doing with these dropout recovery schools? Is an 8% graduation rate really a standard that we should be holding these schools to?
And there's also a question about how easy should it be to turn into a dropout recovery school if you are having problems as a traditional charter school. Should you be able to make this shift so easily and just, you know, almost artificially inflate your grades? I think right now they are getting an F in graduation. Under the new standards, they'd be getting an A. And so is that okay? Should we be allowing these schools to just change their designation and lower the bar? But this is also partially a move to save their sponsor, because it seems like, I think it's every three, if you have bad reviews for 3 years in a row, then your sponsorship is in question. And if the ECOT sponsor gets another bad grade, then that's problematic for both them and other charter schools that this particular sponsor is over.
But you might have noticed, if you watch television at all, that ECOT is continuing to advertise, continuing. And that's taxpayer dollars that are involved in those advertising campaigns there. They're still trying to make the case that they are a needed alternative for kids. You know, they claim an enrollment of about 14,000. But, you know, there are some real questions still about how full-time enrollment is counted and whether ECOT is still following the same ways that they were counting full-time enrollment, which got them in trouble in the first place and got them the $60 million clawback.
Can ECOT survive?
They are right now. And obviously,
because they were fighting this before.
Oh, yeah.
The clawback.
And this is the third year. I mean, like I said, the clawback goes back 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so they're still fighting. They say that they want to take this to the Ohio Supreme Court. And they had actually wanted the clawback to start after the Ohio Supreme Court had ruled. But the Ohio Department of Education did otherwise. So, I mean, ECOT is definitely still fighting whether they can continue to exist. But there's another proposal that's out there that the state auditor, Dave Yost, who used to be an ECOT supporter, spoke at ECOT graduations.
Just last year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's now speaking, I think it was 2015. But
okay, apologies.
He has now said that what needs to happen is that ECOT and other schools that are paying people like, say, ECOT's founder, Bill Lager, who's getting $22 million out of the $100 million that goes to ECOT, Bill Lager gets that for software services and that sort of thing. That money's not changing, even though the state is clawing back $60 million of that $100 million. He says that money should change, that, you know, if you're paying vendors like this, you should have to reduce the money you pay to them if that money's being reduced because of a failure of student enrollment and that sort of thing. Because the argument goes that Bill Lager, who donates an awful lot to Republican office holders and others, that he's not – he continues to make money off this even while ECOT is in this court battle and having their money clawed back. Teachers are getting laid off, and there's real concern about what might be happening with students.
Yes. I think it just remains to be seen whether ECOT can survive this. Moves like the dropout recovery school designation, moves like challenging this in the courts are ways for them to continue to – exist. And I think we will, if they do have to, you know, close their doors per se, there are an awful lot of students who are getting their education through this particular format. I think that raises some questions as well.
They had a rally in the spring where a lot of parents and students came out saying, this is the avenue that we've chosen because our kid doesn't do well in a traditional school environment and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, there are students who have found ECOT and that model beneficial. But you know, it should be said that there are other online charter schools that are out there that are doing better. There are other charter schools that are out there that are serving kids that don't do well in traditional schools. But, you know, this is all about keeping its sponsor and keeping its doors open. And it's a serious issue for them.
Also, I would say that Auditor Yost warned the Ohio Department of Education earlier, a couple weeks ago, not to send full payment to ECOT because ECOT was claiming that on one hand they were saying, oh, if we lose this money, our enrollment's going to drop. And then at the same time they were reporting to ODE like, oh, our enrollment is the same number as before. And Yost was just saying this is a red flag and, you know, don't send full payment.
And it's interesting to follow Yost on this because, like I noted, that he had been a supporter of ECOT. Now he's running for attorney general and has been really out front saying that ECOT has some issues. We need to address them. And they're taking money. They've gotten money that they don't deserve.
Have other schools switched designations from just a regular school, whether it was online or not, to a dropout recovery school? Do we know of any others that have taken this tack?
I can't think of any.
I'm not positive. I know there are a number of dropout recovery schools throughout the state. And
but
like
we don't
Darren
know if
said,
they started that way.
You know, the goal of these particular schools is kind of, you know, in their words, the school of last resort, that students who maybe want to make it in another school have an opportunity to, you know, get an education through this format. And so because they take some of kind of the hardest cases, they are held to a lower standard as far as graduation goes because they're just starting at such a deficit to get these students to the graduation line.
Has any of this affected enrollment at ECOT? Do we know?
Supposedly their ECOT or their enrollment is still around, I think, 13, 14,000. I haven't checked it lately. Uh-huh. But once again, the question is, this is what ECOT was reporting, as Laura was just referencing.
Right.
ECOT has been reporting this an ODE audit and court cases have said that wasn't the case 2 years ago. Why should we believe that this is continuing, you know, if they were not counting the students right a couple years ago, why do we assume that they're counting them right now, especially since the numbers are not that much different?
And no evidence of change in how they're doing it.
And obviously there's been a lot of headlines about ECOT recently because of the court case, because of this clawback and so forth. But ECOT isn't new to kind of questions about its methods and its donations to Republican donors. And so if you've been paying attention, you know, this isn't something that should be surprising that ECOT is involved in.
Yep. If someone else has a question about John Kasich, Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning. I was calling about Kasich's popularity amongst the teachers, police, and nurses. Before his last reelection, he had angered all of our union folks, and I remember going to rallies and things. And because it was, again, teachers, firemen, nurses, the mix of people at these rallies was Democrat and Republican. And yet he, at his reelection time, the ads really had nothing to do with any of that. And we didn't even really know who his opponent was. Where are those three groups right now in supporting Trump? I know, as personally as a teacher, or Kasich for that matter, as a teacher, I was thinking, well, Kasich looks better than Trump. So where are all those people with their votes?
Mm-hmm.
I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. Laura Bischoff.
Well, of course, in early 2011, right out of the gate in the Kasich administration, he signed Senate Bill 5, which was this effort to gut collective bargaining rights for public employee unions. And that set off a firestorm of protests. You know, the people were marching on the lawn of the State House, packing the State House.
First responders, teachers.
Sure. Blah, and it was incredibly contentious. And it immediately was put up for a referendum and was slapped down by the voters pretty resoundingly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, since then, I think that Kasich said, okay, we got delivered a big fat defeat, and I'm going to listen to the people. And he has not pursued like right to work legislation or other things along those lines since then. And I think that there's a hardcore group of union activists who are they will always remember Kasich for signing that bill. But at the same time, you know, when he was up for reelection, the Democrats had an incredibly weak candidate, Ed Fitzgerald, who got hammered in the press because he didn't even have a driver's license. And, you know, Kasich got a cakewalk of a reelection challenge there.
Yeah. They'll never forget. But the right to work issue, that could be something that's taken up by the Ohio General Assembly in the next year and a half, right?
Oh, sure.
It's been proposed a couple of times.
That could be a contentious issue between the General Assembly and Governor Kasich.
Well, they have the votes now, right, potentially to move it forward and override a veto if the governor would.
By the way, right
veto.
To work is anti-union. It's a play on, you know, it's a not exactly what it sounds like.
And Kasich has even referenced the Senate Bill 5 situation in some of his, at least one of his national interviews, talking about that he got overridden by the voters. He listened and he backed off the issue. But, you know, if that one actually does, it's been proposed several times and never gotten really past an initial committee hearing or two. So it would be very interesting to see what would happen if indeed it got passed by the House and the Senate and then it came to him. I mean, one would assume that he would sign it, but he might not sign it. So who knows?
You know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, right. The Senate Bill 5 was, 7 years ago? And I think that there's enough new lawmakers that maybe they don't realize what a powerful backlash that brought forth, that they might be emboldened to say, let's do right to work.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
And to say that, you know, John Kasich is universally loved bipartisanly, I mean, that's not true of any politician. So you have the people on the right who are upset about Medicaid expansion. You have the people on the left who are upset about SB5, who still remember SB5, or, you know, are concerned about the closing of abortion clinics statewide. So he certainly has detractors on both sides. But I think to Karen's point, he has brought up SB5 repeatedly as something that he has learned from.
Mm-hmm. And to Laura's point, though, I mean, Senate Bill 5, when it went to the ballot, I believe it was the largest number of signatures ever gathered to take ballot.
They only needed like 350,000.
And they got over a million.
They got over a million.
And so the final vote was, I think, 61 to 38, somewhere in that area. But that was a pretty big.
Do you remember when they delivered the
it was
petition?
A huge
they
march.
Had them in semi-trucks.
Yeah.
You know, driving right down Broad Street they had people with drums and a big parade, and then they
dramatic.
Delivered it to the Secretary of State's
and
office. It was quite a show.
And this was after we had seen multitudes of committee hearings that brought in huge numbers of people. It was the kind of demonstrations that we had been seeing in Wisconsin and in other states brought in front of the State House. I mean, hundreds, even thousands of people coming out in not the best weather sometimes, yep, to complain about how quickly this issue was going forward and how they felt like they were not being heard.
And they jammed the State House so much so that the State Highway Patrol had to close down. You know, it became kind of a hazard.
Yeah.
I remember like the catwalks over the atrium were just very, very crowded. I did not want to be on the catwalk with
right,
all those people.
We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. With me here in the studio, Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Jesse Balmert, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. We're going to turn now to what's ahead for the Ohio General Assembly. They've got, another year and a half to go for this session? So,
Now the budget's done.
The budget's done.
The gates are open, right?
Yeah. You know, what do they have up their sleeve? But before we do that, I wanted to talk about this dogs on the patio thing at restaurants and what the – I mean, there's the issue of whether or not you can bring your dog on a patio at a restaurant. But then there's this larger issue of home rule. Once again, the Ohio General Assembly jumping in and making rules for local governments. Jesse Balmert?
Yeah, so essentially the way it's set up right now is in Ohio, you aren't allowed to have your dog on a patio. And that's Ohio Department of Health actually has regulations about, you know, safety and health and so forth. And so the proposal from a couple lawmakers, including Bill Coley down in our part of Ohio, is that business owners would be able to make their own decision about whether dogs could be on the patio. And they would also still have to comply with all kind of health and food safety provisions. And I think, honestly, there were some restaurants that didn't know they weren't allowed to have dogs on patios, yeah, including one in Columbus, a brewery that got in a little bit of trouble or were at least alerted by the local health department that they weren't allowed to have dogs on the patio after they had had a couple of fundraisers and events and so forth. And so the question is really, should we allow dogs on patios? Is this a health concern? Is this a safety concern? Or, you know, should people just let Fido hang out while you're drinking your coffee or your beer?
Thoughts?
I can see it both ways. I mean, there's people who really love having their dogs everywhere they go, etc. But then there's a lot of people who are not really dog people. They might be allergic or they might be afraid of dogs.
I thought of allergies.
There's a little bit of the gross out factor. Like, do you?
What happens if?
What happens if? Like,
et cetera, et cetera,
et cetera, et cetera.
The unmentionable.
And also,
Yeah.
Go either way.
I think that some businesses are feeling like this is an opportunity to really bring in millennials who don't have kids, who treat their dogs as kids and want to bring their dogs out with them. But like Laura's right. I mean, there's people that are allergic. They're afraid that they are concerned about dogs misbehaving, biting people, whatever. So the idea of turning it over to the business to make the choice, I suppose, is interesting to some people. But others are, hey, a restaurant's not a place for a dog.
Hmm.
And look, I'm a cat owner, not a particular dog person, but I think the argument of the dog lobby, if you will, is that, you know, people don't have to go to restaurants that have dogs, and that's a choice that the business is making to attract a certain type of clientele and also perhaps put off other people who might be coming to their business. And that's a decision that they should be allowed to make. And, you know, Bill Coley, as both a fan of small government and his two dogs, is a defender of this.
I will predict that the Pooch on the Patio bill will move quicker than Bill Beagle's. I'm not kidding. His name is Bill Beagle, and he's sponsoring a bill to clean up Ohio's vicious dog laws. This is in response to a horrible case in Dayton in which a woman named Clonda Ritchie was mauled to death by her neighbor's dogs, and he proposed some changes, and it went nowhere. It died in lame duck last time around, and he's been pushing for it again. But it's for some reason, it's a very tough sell.
Ohio has a history of tough sells when it comes to regulating
animals.
Animals in the state of
Ohio. Puppy mills, cockfighting, all these things. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and keep in mind that we had the exotic animal. We were sort of a haven for that until that incident out in Zanesville, which still sounds like some sort of fake news. I mean, the idea that the guy he let loose all of his lions, tigers, bears, monkeys,
zebras.
I can't remember.
I was reporting in Newark at the time, which is right near Zanesville, and one of my editors was like, oh, we think there is a bear loose in kind of the area between
check?
These two counties. They're like, can you go check? So like young reporter Jesse drives out there like, what happens if I find a bear? Like, what am I? I'm not going to interview the bear. Like, what is going to go on here? It was anyway.
Yeah, that was memorable. That's for sure. And
right,
sad.
And then the sheriff's department had to. I mean, they were the
killing,
first responders
shooting.
Had to go shoot and kill
all these innocent animals,
dozens of animals.
And then we found out how many of these kinds of places there were that people were keeping big cats like tigers and lions, and
alligator in the basement,
and snakes, and all these exotic animals in their homes or in sanctuaries that they built on their properties. And it was pretty stunning to talk to some of these people and find out what kind of animals they were keeping.
Yeah, and then the state built like a whole.
Yeah,
there's a facility out in Reynoldsburg
where they take them in.
Yes,
where they take them in, and it's taxpayer funded.
But yeah, we have no idea what's in there and how many are in there.
Why?
Because there's a fear that it would cause a problem with people who live near that area. They don't want to disclose how many animals they have in there and anything about them. Which is it's troubling. I mean, I think we all went through. We got a tour of the place before it opened, so you could see the cages and that sort of thing. And it's a very secure facility, but there's a fear of causing panic among people who live out there. If you tell them, hey, we've got this venomous snake or this injured tiger or whatever.
What are they supposed to do with the animals once they have them?
I think the whole goal was to try to. Get them to remove them from wherever they were living in Ohio illegally without a permit and make sure that they were in reasonable health so they could be transferred to a sanctuary,
kind of
a facility that actually is licensed to care for these animals.
Huh. All right. We have a few more minutes left. What else is ahead in the Ohio General Assembly? What are their priorities going to be?
Well, the Ohio Right to Life is pushing a bill that would prohibit terminating pregnancies once a diagnosis of Down syndrome has been made.
Even if it's within the legal time frame.
Right. And, the part of the strategy of Ohio Right to Life, it's been a very successful one, is to kind of chip away piece by piece by piece. It's been very incremental. What I think is interesting about this is that, once this diagnosis has been made, I guess, there's a high percentage of people who decide to terminate. And how is it that, fetuses with Down syndrome are going to get a protection, but those with other genetic conditions do not? I mean,
I think they're saying it's a slippery slope then.
Well, I think it's part of the incremental approach, which
is
get the ones with Down syndrome and then move on to the next and the next and the next and the next.
Yes, but then just to take it a step further beyond disabilities and special needs, what about a perfectly healthy, normal, fetus?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's the ultimate goal of Ohio Right to Life is to eliminate abortion entirely, regardless of the reason.
Mm-hmm. So, and we also have the heartbeat bill back again. It was something that passed through the legislature in lame duck last year. And so it's something that's been reintroduced and that previously John Kasich vetoed. So it'll be interesting whether that'll come back and whether now that they have kind of shown their ability to override vetoes, whether that's something that they would pursue. But
and there's going to be there are several gun bills, Stand Your Ground. And then also I know Nino Vitale from Urbana has a bill that would allow elected office holders with legitimate CCWs to carry their weapons into government buildings. So, and I was asking him, like, of the 66 Republican members of the House, how many of them have CCWs? And he was thinking maybe half. Hmm. So, you know, you could have.
And there may be some Democrats who might, too.
You know, I talked to Leader Strayhorn, and he said he wasn't aware of anybody on the Democratic side who had a CCW. Hmm. I mean, he may not have surveyed them, but.
And there's also another bill related to firearms, whether or not you would have to tell a police officer that you have a concealed handgun license when you're pulled over. Currently, that is a requirement, but there's a
to
proposal.
Say you have a license or to say you have a weapon.
To say you have a weapon.
You have a weapon, okay. If you have a license, yes.
Right.
And so that is another item related to firearms that could come up.
Why that? I mean, why is that an issue?
I think the argument on one side is that police officers could just look it up in their records, whether or not you have a CCW license, and that, you know, the general argument that gun owners are no less safe than the average citizen in Ohio. And then on the other side, police are saying, hey, we would like as much information as possible about the person that we are questioning, and it would be nice to know if they have a firearm on them.
What else?
There's also a bill that my colleague Andy Chow is looking into about that would create a long-range financial outlook council that would look at state budget. This is interesting following up on the budget from last time around because there were some lawmakers who were very concerned about budget estimates being off for 11 of 12 months
That's right.
It came to personal income tax collections. And so this kind of speaks, I think, a little to this tension that we're talking about between the Kasich administration and state lawmakers. And there seemed to be a real lack of trust in those budget numbers. And so this bill kind of addresses that, and it just – it could be very interesting.
Did Budget Director Tim Keene ever figure it out why they were so off?
He's talked about different things like, you know, income tax refunds coming in above schedule and some other things that – you know, there didn't seem to be one reason. And now in the first month of the fiscal year, it looked like things are close to being back on track in terms of forecasting. Mm. But there are still some weaknesses in like the sales tax, for instance, and some other things. So and he's also talked about what state lawmakers did with Medicaid spending and the rules that they put on Medicaid spending. He fears is going to make Medicaid unstable. And that was the only thing that saved the state from not going into the red at the end of the fiscal year last year, was underspending in Medicaid.
Right. Right.
So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very wonkish, I guess. But it's still it's really important when you start thinking about this will be, you know, if the budget does go into the red, then you start looking at serious budget cuts potentially.
And other things that we brought up. I mean, right to work could come up. There was this push to reform unemployment compensation that we were supposed to have a plan for in the spring and, you know,
that's gone nowhere.
Haven't heard the results of that one yet. So that could be something that they pulled together. There was a lot of discussion of, you know, the alternative energy sources, and that could come up again. It seems like now that we are done with the budget, which was the focus of so much of the attention of the first half of the year, mm-hmm. Now it's, you know, to the lawmakers to chart the course for the rest of the session.
The unemployment compensation fund has been broken for several years. There's just not enough money coming in and too much money going out. And the solutions are just not very appealing.
They're not politically palatable.
Right. I mean, either you make businesses pay more or you make injured workers accept less, or you do a combination of the two.
You mean not injured workers, but unemployed workers.
I'm sorry, unemployed workers.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just not that palatable. And I think that's why we haven't seen a fix for so long.
And I wanted to add one more thing real quick. A question came up before about ECOT and moving into a dropout recovery school. Little research shows that nobody's tried to do that. So this would be kind of trailblazing if ECOT is able to do that and kind of salvage itself in a way.
Karen Kassler, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also, Jesse Ballmer, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
Jesse Ballmer is state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Laura Bischoff, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks. Have a great week.
Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.